Welcome to the Optimal Health Podcast from Hudson Physicians, getting you back to optimal health when you're feeling sick, stressed, overwhelmed, or run down. Today, our discussion is with Dr. Lincoln Lickness. He attended the College of Augustana College. That's in Rock Island, Illinois, right?
Nope, there's more than one. That was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Okay, Sioux Falls. I guessed one or the other. We'll go there. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and went on to medical school at Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. His residency was at the University of Wisconsin and then Aurora Family Medicines, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Dr. Lickness performs spine injections, non-surgical orthopedic care to get his patients back to action. He runs a state-of-the-art sports concussion program and has served as medical director of several local races and for many teams in high schools all the way up to the professional level. On this show, we'll hone in on concussions especially. We're going to discuss the nature of them along with things that you, Dr. Lickness, do with them and then talk about some prevention and care and what to do. Work for you?
That sounds awesome.
Hey, thanks for joining me today. Taking the time out to make this happen. So from the very beginning, let's just talk about you just a little bit. What got you into medicine and kind of take us through your path and how you landed in sports medicine.
Sounds good. I grew up in South Dakota. My father was a family physician there, and I always compared every other career path to his and just seemed natural for me. I went to osteopathic medical school, which is pretty much combining a chiropractic background and a allopathic or an MD type background into one. So you learn how to do manipulation and use your hands and a lot more physical exam type things that are taught in that school in that pathway. And spine is one area, and then neuroanatomy is another area that's emphasized. So I then went on to family medicine, as you mentioned. And then after that, I did two more years. So I did a sports medicine fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic and then followed that with a spine medicine fellowship there. And that's where you really get the concussion work in there and all the training for that and become a specialist. Beyond that, I passed the board exam for TBI, for traumatic brain injury. So I'm double board certified in traumatic brain injury. And Jason Lee is also our other provider that's an osteopath as well. And he is sports medicine credentialed and board certified in this type of thing as well. And we have two other members on our team now. It started with just me 11 years ago, starting this practice and building this up. And now we're to four specialists in this area. So we have Shannon Vasky and Greg Barlow as well. And all four of us can help people with this injury.
So 11 years ago, you're here, right, at Hudson Physicians. And you take a look at things and say, hey, wait, we don't have a sports medicine set up here. Let's go. Is that kind of what happened? And how did the genesis of that get created?
Well, I think that was at the middle of the turning of the tide where everybody went from kind of too hardcore, put some dirt on it attitude to let's take this injury seriously and let's protect these kids that are hurt and trying to get back to sports. And there's a right way and a wrong way. And so people were hungry for that, but we also were in the period of time where we were changing minds and helping schools establish programs, both preventive stuff like if you need to change rules on what type of hits are allowed or how do you train. And the equipment's come a long way as well. So you establish that. And then when you're hurt, that's when we step in. We try to do everything we can to prevent those injuries, but that's really what we do is how do we get you healthy again? And when do you know when you can get back to the activities you love doing? So that's our part of the injury care here at the clinic. And then we communicate with the school and with an employer or other people involved, the parents, and make sure everybody's kind of on the same page and that it goes well. So you have some prevention parts of the program, and then the bulk of it is how do you heal or rehab someone back. And then the clearance part's interesting. So that's four steps essentially to meet your clearance criteria, which means you're symptom-free. You're no longer struggling in class or anything like that. You've passed our exams, and then you've made it through the typical five-day exertion protocol, which means you start with a little bit of activity, work your way all up to your full sport, but over sequential about 5 days if it goes perfectly. So those are the things that people need to have happen to get back to their activity and be cleared, and that's the five steps are really what people call the concussion protocol. Say the NFL or whatever, they always say somebody's in the protocol. That's what they're doing. So those are the types of things that we're either providing or monitoring with help with the athletic trainers at the schools.
Is there some sort of reporting then that goes on from you to the school to the various league? So if it's a Wisconsin high school governing body. Do they have to communicate that some way somehow, or is it just kind of between you and the school?
So it's more at the local level as far as that goes. We don't send like WIAA or Minnesota mm-hmm. State League or anything. But we do need, the school needs written documentation of when someone's hurt and when someone's cleared. And they keep close records on that. They don't want to have anything slip through the cracks
yep.
for the own benefit of their own athletes. And so we do provide that. We also have internal communication. We have an app called Healthy Roster that we utilize. So the activities director can see real time what we're doing. A parent or a coach could connect with us through the app, even in a video chat type thing or
excellent.
Like a FaceTime style discussion if it needed to happen. And then we update what we've got on our injury. And then we have more formal documentation that we have to do on our end of it too, which could be sent somewhere.
So none of this, I would guess, from the rubbing the dirt on it 11 years ago, really existed, correct? I mean, this is all a direct byproduct of technology and the tools and the things that you have been able to put together to make this happen.
Yeah, we're really state of the art. When we first developed it, it was just typical, you know, do you have a headache? And, well, why don't you just rest for the next 2 weeks? Or it was a 1, 2, or 3 week graded protocol, which we realized wasn't accurate whatsoever. So that went away immediately. And since then, we've been state of the art, and we use all the latest technology and latest research, and we incorporate it, and we're always updating anything that we can utilize. In the last few years, we've started utilizing more balance and eye rehabilitation, mm-hmm. screening, as well as treatment, which is done at the clinic level or in conjunction with physical therapy, typically. So those are the most recent changes that we've implemented. Now, we also used to be very heavy on the rest, and now we're more on a functional rest where, you know, you get a little closer to the end of healing, we'll actually start you exercising under the athletic trainers or someone that knows what they're doing a little early. So you might get on a stationary bike for 10 minutes real easy. And that is actually speeding up the healing. But before, we wouldn't do that. And way back, we would actually do none of it. So,
yeah, well, you got a headache, move on, right? That yeah. type of thing. So let's start from the beginning of what we're really talking about, the core of a concussion. What really is it? How is it defined?
So we call it an energy crisis. Really, it takes either a whack to the head or a whiplash type or a shaken kind of an incident where your brain cells are overwhelmed. They just are making mistakes. When they make mistakes because they've been hurt, they produce symptoms. So we have a list of 22 most common symptoms, and there can be others. But
22?
We screen for these 22
wow.
most commonly. It's the most universal form that is out there for coaches to use in their kit, you know, when their athletes are hurt and then they have to think of this the 1 or 2 times mm-hmm. a season or whatever if we're not around. So it's readily available. It's called the SCAT list. SCAT 5 is the latest version. Soon there'll be 6 and 7. I'm sure we always update this every yeah. 1 to 2 years. So we use these symptoms, and it's the typical headache, dizzy, vision changes. I don't feel right. It might be that you're emotional when normally you're not. Like if you're crying in the middle of a game when normally you should just be excited to be there and whatever. Those are things that we're keying in on. So we have these things that we watch for, and not one thing makes a difference. It has to be the collective picture and, you know, the setting of an injury typically. And then we do some balance tests. We do some eye coordination tests. We do memory or cognitive type quizzes and tests, and it can be as simple as, can you remember the most basic things like what you eat today and so on? And then we have other tests like, can you spell a word backwards or repeat a series of numbers backwards? And it gets kind of hard to do. It seems like the kids are showing up the adults usually on this.
Hey, it's kind of hard even when you're good, right?
So they're hard sometimes, but it's more how you perform.
Is there a situation where if you come up upon someone that you suspect being concussed, but maybe they're not, like where you say, you know, how do you know? I guess, I mean, I know you can't really see it.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a couple examples I have. One is, you know, say somebody gets shaken up pretty good on a hit on an athletic
yeah.
field of some kind, and they come off under their own power, but you're kind of concerned, you want to make sure they're okay to go back in. And then sometimes the athlete does get to go back in. How does that happen
yeah.
when they were just shaken up? Well, there is the old like ding type injury where you don't really have a concussion. You just, you know, maybe had the wind knocked out of you, or you even saw stars just for a second, but there really wasn't an injury there. It just stunned you or whatever. And so through our screening process, we can make sure that someone is safe and figure out the ones that are not to go back. So you have to pass everything to return to sport that then and there. And by law, you have to have someone trained, preferably an athletic trainer or a physician in sports medicine, something like that, trained in this to do that clearance on the sideline to allow for the athlete to go back in. And so if you don't pass that, then we go through the rest of the process for those people. The other thing would be, this looks like a lot of other things sometimes when it's subtle, meaning I had an athlete that came in that had a friend that tested positive for COVID not long ago. And so there was a potential exposure, weren't real sure. They had some headaches, didn't feel quite right. They had hit the back of their head on the basketball court a couple days prior. So it was kind of blending together, but it wasn't really specific. That person had both COVID and a concussion.
No.
So, you know, we tested for COVID in the clinic, which we can do, and it was positive. And so then she went into quarantine, and then she also did not pass her concussion testing from the other perspectives of the eye coordination and so on. So she had both.
Wow.
Sometimes they just have one. We rule out concussion. So it really depends on the individual and how the testing comes out.
Is there a level of or differences in severity? If so, what are they?
So there was multiple different ways we would clarify a concussion. Pretty much now we just say mild and severe.
Yeah.
And so mild is most of them. And severe would be you have either like a cranial fracture or a brain bleed, something more extravagant. Most commonly you'd be in a hospital or maybe even in a rehab unit, something like that, for one of those more involved injuries. So the majority of us will have the mild concussion now. And that's going to be totally encompassing to most symptoms. And then you just say it's really symptomatic or it's not. You can kind of talk to them about how active it is. And there might be somebody that has a little bit more emotional control than others. And so they might reduce their symptoms. There might be somebody worried about not getting back to play soon, so they're going to tell me they don't have any symptoms.
None. Feeling great.
Yeah. Yep. So we have to dig through that stuff a little bit and figure out what we really have in reality and then go forward. So,
man, that must be really tricky when you think about you're trusting the patient being stewards of themselves to you, yet they're kind of being stewards to the game and wanting to play when you can't, you know. You can tell what you can tell, right? But it really depends a lot on the player too, right?
Yeah. Their report is just one piece of the pie.
Yeah.
And that's just telling me how they feel. And you can usually tell when somebody's either covering something up or whatever. It's pretty easy. It's actually extremely rare now. When I first started 11 years ago, it was super common. And most commonly, it was the dad or somebody.
Wow. Think about that.
Doing that because they wanted their kid to go pro or whatever the right thing. So at this point, it's rare. Exactly. It's rare. Most people are very in tune to the seriousness of it. And if you do it right, it's not as big of a deal. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And you can totally heal and not have long-term damage. We do have baseline testing, and most high schools now use IMPACT. There's other versions of this, but it's called neuropsych testing. And it's like a brain quiz, 25 minutes on a computer. There's also paper forms of it. So if a school or a team, a lot of club-level teams don't want to get their whole team over to test on our computer for 25 minutes, although that's available as well. But you have a baseline when you're not hurt. So if you can do that in a preseason, or for most high schools, it's ninth and 11th graders will test. And for some smaller schools that don't have as much, say, budget or resource or whatever, they would maybe pick just the highest risk sports.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're cross country, unlikely to get hurt with a head injury, maybe those don't get tested. But in general, most schools will test just all athletes in those ranges. And a good 2-year span is fine. There's not as much development that will change the score.
Sure.
Now, if you take the test a couple times, you might be getting better at it then. So the more you take it, the more accurate this data will be. So if we ever had a gray zone, it's always nice to fall back to the baseline and see how it compares. Because if someone comes in and says, I'm perfect, but I got hit in the head the other night, and they don't pass that test in comparison to the baseline, their score is way down, they're injured. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is if we have a gut check that something's not right, it's not aligning, we think they might be hurt and they're trying to cover it up just so they can get back to the championship.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be mean or anything, but we need to health is first.
Yeah.
We'll just stay more conservative. So we'll make them go through at least that 5-step protocol. Everybody has to do that anyway when you've had a head injury. unless it's been ruled out completely immediately. So there's some safeguards built in to make sure that no one slips through the cracks.
So would you say that you're a big proponent of the baseline testing and getting that done?
Well, it's super helpful for what we do.
Yeah.
I think every school that has the resources should do that. Sometimes employers will use that if it's a higher risk job,
sure,
you know, for head injury or falls or things like that. It can be used all the way down to, I believe, age 5 now.
Wow.
Now, and there are different versions of the test, mm-hmm, and I feel that anybody under 12, it's getting a little harder to be reliable or be accurate all the time. But the more you have baselines, the better you're able to help somebody. But I think for the most part, the sports that are higher risk, football, hockey, cheer is actually really, really high from the everybody's throwing up in the air and all,
yep,
you know, and tumbling and things. Those are probably your biggest, soccer as well, you know, just from collisions head to head and occasionally heading, you know, you can do repetitive head impacts too, and that can cause concussions. One time I had a state champ diver from River Falls, and he was really, really good, and he would practice an extra half hour to an hour beyond the rest of the team after he was done. Well, he was taking that many more blows to the head, and he ended up with it was mid-season. We were able to fix this guy up before he had lost his opportunity to win the state championship, which he did. But he ended up developing a concussion from repetitive head injuries or impacts.
Yeah.
They have research also and say, like, football linemen, well, every play you hit your front of your head on another guy's front of his head, and so does that do anything? Well, it's not dangerous in and of itself, but they did show that there's some changes in some of these athletes that could promote them into causing a concussion if they got just a little bit bigger blow.
Well, and there was that Steve Mongo McMichael issue when he was a left tackle. When he'd be coming off the ball, he'd have the head-to-head contact, as you just mentioned, or as the DNs would like to shove their hands up right off the bottom of the face mask, you have that head snapping back. So you have that snapping motion, you have head-to-head, but then there's some spinal stuff, and you do work with that too.
Yep, we have a sports and spine practice, so you know a good half of what we do is the spine-related stuff too as well. And I find that a lot of head injuries, you're going to get both of those in the mix.
Right.
They're connected. They're gonna get hurt. When you don't, it's just easier to handle. But most of the time, there's going to be at least a whiplash-type injury or something along those lines. It can even be contributing to some of the balance problems or dizziness that people may have, and it's coming out of their neck. There's also the discs and the joints of the neck can cause headaches. So a lot of times when it's hanging up for a while longer than it should to take to resolve, it might be the neck, or it could be a vision issue where the motor function of the eye isn't working quite right. So we look for those different types of the injury to heal people faster here.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, there's 6 main subtypes that we're really eyeballing most of the time. Just regular cognitive ones, balance issues, vision, mood. And so we're just screening for these things every time they're in, trying to figure out, mm-hmm, what might need to be added. Oh, sleep is another one. Sometimes when you got a head injury, you get insomnia, and it's either with the starting of trying to fall asleep, or sometimes you wake up and can't fall back asleep. Well, if it's not right away, you're going to lose a lot of potential to heal yourself faster, because that's when the majority of the rebuilding occurs, is when you're at rest. Now, we still need to function, and you need to stimulate the brain to recover nicely, but the sleeping, getting a good 8 hours, 10 hours rest when you're hurt, especially as a younger person, like an athlete in middle school or high school, that's important. That's the biggest benefit right there.
So the old adage of wake someone up every 2 hours, not really that big of a deal.
Well, there's one circumstance where that's the thing you do. So if you're freshly hurt coming off the field and we're worried about what's called an epidural bleed in the brain, within 1 to 3 hours, typically you'll have an unconscious person again, and that'll be an emergency. So after the first, say, 3 hours or so, if they're really stable and doing fine, you really aren't going to need to wake up your average person with a concussion,
sure,
anymore. And the rest is really important thereafter. Certainly after a day or two, you aren't going to want to do that. You're going to want them to get their rest.
So it's just a matter to make sure they're not unconscious. Really,
yeah,
is what you're,
looking for a different injury than a concussion. Now, they might be in the same
Got
person.
It. Yeah.
But you're looking for some brain that's bleeding and going to end,
yeah,
up with a death, you know. So that actually has a different treatment. It's a surgical treatment. And so that one would go right to the emergency room or 911 if that was happening, where you couldn't arouse somebody, or if somebody had a head injury, say you're at wherever, you're at your lake cabin, and a family member has an injury, and you're watching them because you're away from resources, and all of a sudden they're starting to fade neurologically, or they aren't as arousable anymore, or they have a shaking incident. Those are red flags that this person needs, you know, 911 action at that point. Beyond the first, you know, period of time, 3 to 12 hours, even 24 hours, you're pretty much beyond that window for most people.
Great. That's good to know, right? The average Joe like myself wouldn't know that. So very helpful.
I do have some parents that are just exhausted by the time they come in, say Monday or Tuesday, to have the recheck, you know, or whatever with their kid, and they've been doing that.
Yeah.
So it's not all that common, but certainly without having that kind of advice, you're going to do what you feel is appropriate. You know, no matter what, for you or your child or your person and your family.
Before we get into treatments and cares and those types of things, what about protective headgear? Is it good, overrated, false sense of security? Your thoughts?
Very necessary. Now, the one thing with mouth guards is that that's mostly going to save you from an oral trauma or a tooth that's going to break or fall out of there. But it is shock absorption as well. Now, we have not been able to prove that mouth guards will prevent a concussion, but it is still very helpful, very appropriate for these contact sports.
So if you're a mouth guard company, and there were a ton of them about 15 years ago that were fashioning themselves as concussion-preventing right. mouth guards, we don't know that even today.
Yeah, they were pushing the limit on the marketing.
Remember?
There.
Yeah.
Now, the helmets, there's a little more to that. So there's growing evidence, and that's where most of the research that, say, the NFL is funding and so on, is going, is there anything else other than rule changes and illegal hits and just different things? Because our athletes keep getting bigger and stronger every year. So what can we do? So they're trying to see if helmets will help. And at this point, they're not going to – I wouldn't tell someone they're going to prevent a concussion, but they sure seem to be helping as the technology gets a mm-hmm. little bit better, at least mitigating the severity. Or some of them maybe are prevented. It's kind of a tough thing to dial in there. But I would say that they're still very important, but you do want to ask your sports provider if before you spend $700 or a couple $1,000 on a certain helmet or whatever.
You know, one thing I've noticed, name the sport, it used to be at the younger levels, it would be kind of no fear, tough guy. You didn't really respect your opponent's body. Then we saw the professionals start doing that more and more as time has worn on here. And I feel as though it's kind of bleeding down into the high school levels a little bit more. Maybe the youth, it's a little bit too heavy to get into. But it seems as though there's a little more respect for what could happen on the other end of that helmet-to-helmet hit, or the hands getting up, or the elbows getting up. It seems like there's a general educational process going on. Are you aware of anything that's being done in that way from your position in this world of sports?
Yeah, I think a lot of the governing bodies and the state associations are really driving a lot of that. They make you have literature in your locker rooms and things. And even when I played, you know, 25, 30 years ago, those things existed a little bit. It was like tackle heads up and stuff like that. Mostly it was to avoid a spearing neck injury, not so much the head injuries. But I don't know if it's required anymore, but it's certainly very visible in the athletic training rooms and so on. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to go through an annual kind of primer on concussion awareness, whether you're an athlete, a coach, or and a lot of times they'll tie it in even to parent meetings. We'll commonly be the speaker and come give that talk and remind everybody again how serious it is. And I think we've done it so many times now over a decade that there's just – you know, rampant respect for what this really is, and that we get one brain. If we prevent injuries, then you're going to be fully functional. Whereas some of these high-profile cases are illustrating that there's some unlucky people that have had way too many concussions, and they aren't doing so well anymore. That chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, that's a real thing. It's hard to diagnose because the only way you can really prove it is after someone's passed and you do an autopsy and see the damaged cells that's specific to it. So we're looking for ways to, you know, predict that or predict certain genes that are more likely to be hurt. So if someone has this gene, you get two concussions, should that person pick a different sport versus the person that doesn't have that gene? Can you keep playing, you know, and have an extra concussion, if you will, or whatever, and be risk-free for long-term damage or not? Those are the things we're working on in the field now. But we don't have answers for everything yet, but we're getting closer and closer all the time.
Well, it was interesting you bring that up. I have a friend of mine who's works in the medical profession, and he had a young player who's my son's age, mid-20s now, and they're probably in high school. His sophomore year, he had suffered his second of two concussions, maybe had one his freshman year. It was happening a lot. He said, no mas, you're done. Is there a level where you do think that that's not a bad idea? I mean, it's person by person, but I feel like he came from a position in the profession knowing what could happen that he said, this isn't that important.
Sure. I always start with saying, well, you never know what's going to happen as you go forward because we're going to be around a lot longer. And so you might slip on the ice 1 year and you might have a car crash 1 year and then you might hit your head at home hanging something on the wall. So there's opportunities to get head injuries as you get older, too, that you have to think about even when you're a 15-year-old athlete or
whatever. Compiling
right.
effect, right?
So and we don't know, and it's probably going to be individualized as to how many injuries can someone handle, right? There might be somebody that could have two or three injuries, and now they're going to deal with some depression symptoms as they get a little older or some forgetfulness a little earlier in life than maybe they should. Those types of things can happen to people commonly with repetitive head injuries. And then there's some people that seem to be able to tolerate more than that. You know, they can have the multiple head injuries and end up being lucky and not having anything wrong. I usually start talking to people about risk reduction, change of sport, change of habits, maybe even just choice on what how you do a sport. One thing is a lot of people snowboard around here. Well, that's not their main sport. That's their fun thing. But they're on the train park or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, if they've had three concussions in football or whatever sport they like, and now they're on the train park, that's a bad choice. You can just go bored and enjoy the sport and lessen your risk quite a bit than when you're trying to jump off of everything. So we talk about different ways to make decisions when they're at an age where that's really hard for them to do.
Yeah.
So we spend a lot of time counseling. That's one of the main benefits with our clinic is that rather than just it's the concussion, here you go, here's when you're cleared, you get all the extra stuff. You get the coordination of school. We'll talk to the teachers for you and so on if needed. We'll provide the documentation. We help you with things at home. Most of them are on their phones all the time. That can be a problem. So we try to, and it's not necessarily that you should be absolutely no screens because everything is screens, but screen exposure can slow down healing of a concussion. So we talk to them about here's how you still live your life when you're hurt and you're trying to get through this and don't feel alienated from your friends and everyone else. But here's also how you can speed up the healing process so you don't end up spending 4 hours on your phone and then have two extra weeks of symptoms.
So we'll get into the treatment part of things. Someone's diagnosed. By the way, before we get to there, yourself and Dr. Jason Lee, who I've spoken to on these past two podcasts, super confident, comfortable speaking to people, know your profession, know what you're doing. I think it's going to be very easy for any athlete or athlete's parents or schools to speak with people like you in this profession because you have passion for what you do, you care about what you do, and you know what you're doing. I mean, that's just, if people don't get anything out of this podcast, I'm just telling you, that's what's right here before us. So they're lucky in this area to have you guys.
Well, we just love it. Passion is the right word. All four of us would just do this for free if that was the method.
That's what he said.
Yeah, I mean, we just love doing it. My favorite thing is to be on a field somewhere on a Friday night. My wife's been gracious enough to let me do it for all these years, and
superstar,
just knows that's my
sure.
life, you know. And so that's what we live for is being there with the athletes. For me, it's kind of funny. I live vicariously through the energy of all these young athletes
right.
and stuff, you know, so it's my way of staying with it. But I like to give something back, and yeah, if we didn't have to pay for all the bills and the salaries of the people that work here and so on, we'd just do it for free anyway because we just love it. And we like seeing it done well. We like seeing it done at the highest level. What we like is to perform concussion care and treatment safely, first of all, and get you back as fast as you possibly can. Possibly better than, you know, say a competitor or whatever. And there's nothing fancy about that. It's just doing it really well and knowing where your clear boundaries and how to run your tests and management of all those little things that take an extra 5-10 minutes of counseling to do well. That's really the magic.
So is treatment really a lot about interpersonal, face-to-face, testing, talking, assessing?
So I think the first thing is I start with diagnosis. What do we have here? What are the parts and pieces? You know, is it just a standard concussion? Do you have a whiplash with it? Do you have anything else? Are you actually sick right now? Do we have to help you get over your illness as well? You know, those types of things. So once you have the parts, now everything else comes together. So then it comes down to communication. First, I have to make sure that the parent and the athlete know exactly what they need to do, and then the rest is up to them. And then we have a follow-up period. So usually it's about a week in between. And once we see that they're getting to the symptom-free place in time, then we start that exertion protocol. And that's really when their athletic trainer at their school kind of steps in, and they're the eyes in the field kind of thing. And they usually do most of that with their team. That's just restricted and a little more each day until you're all the way back. And so we usually run the impact test right about the time they're going to do that or somewhere in that exertion protocol to be sure that we're not missing something before they go to contact drills.
Yeah.
So that's usually the timing of the testing. As far as treatment goes, I'd say in general, it's more of a shutdown or a rest type of a thing. And we try to make sure that they have their sleep cycle right and their nutrition and hydration right, and they know how to do their studies. Teachers are communicating. Maybe there's things that can be printed off to lessen the screen burden. We know that they're supposed to put their phones down unless they need to, say, coordinate their life with the teachers or whatever, or communicate with friends. And you can talk on a phone. That actually works for that still. Most people just text and...
it's a really novel concept, isn't it? Try that.
So I usually throw that joke out there, and the kids look at me like...
What are you talking about?
I know. But those are the basics. And then the more higher-level stuff would be if they need a form of rehabilitation, certain medicines. There's brain stimulants. There's sleep aids, so on. There's not a whole lot of supplements that are really proven to make a big difference. And we have looked at fish oil and anti-inflammatories and different things. And there is occasional moments where we'll use those things if the symptoms are too much for someone, or say their neck is really bad, then maybe oral prednisone or a steroid or whatever occasionally can be utilized for somebody like that. So that's the different parts of treatment when you individualize it.
Got it. As far as what's new on the horizon for your program at Hudson Physicians, what does that look like?
Boy, we're excited for our new destination. We're going to have a field house in there. The rehabbers and us will be right in the same building. So we already communicate very well real-time using our technology, but now we can actually be at the same visit if necessary and in the same hallway talking about it or whatever. So the coordination of care will be great. Should have a one-stop shop destination center for that. So it should expand the ability to communicate, should expand hours, accessibility to us. We'll have brand new, not only state-of-the-art way we do this, but even the physical entity will be state-of-the-art now and brand new. So I'm excited for where we're going. We continually are watching for the next test or thing that we need to incorporate into the program. And so when those things come up, we actually have them implemented usually within a week or so once we have it vetted and everything. So whatever is appropriate and going to help us do this better, we're going to incorporate immediately.
Always maintaining a nimble approach. I mean, when you think about how this all started and then you look ahead to today, it's probably a mile ahead from where it was. And it's because you're willing to do your vetting, take a look at things and say, yeah, let's put this in and get results.
Absolutely. There's some things that we look at that we realize aren't ready yet and or are a little bit hyped up or need some more vetting. And then there's some things that just practically don't make sense, you know. But for the most part, when something really does fit or add a layer of security or enhancement to this program, then we've got it in there within a few days to a week. The nice thing about being a smaller practice is that that stuff doesn't get hung up in committee or anything like that. You just figure out what it takes to implement it. So
that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
The red tape kind of goes away. So if you're a high school in Western Wisconsin in this vast area, the place to be is here at Hudson Physicians with Dr. Lickness and his team with their sports medicine program. All of the things that you're doing, if you're a school that you haven't been able to contact with him, you might want to do it. Sounds like a really good idea as you look to expand and really be beacons and leaders here in this area.
Yep, we started that way. We're always there for every school or organization in the area. We get lots of calls and questions. We're happy to do that courtesy. Some people need our full scale of support with an athletic trainer in the clinic or in the school and working with their nurses and their teachers coming doing presentations. Those things we do offer. We are not at capacity. We're definitely able to help anybody. We also can be consultants too. So when I first started, I helped every school in the area get started with their program. And then everybody kind of caught up. And for a while there, I was mostly a consultant for majority of the schools. And now we're coming back around to the full-scale program for many of them again.
That is fantastic stuff. Dr. Lincoln Lickness, thanks for joining us here today. Great program, good information. I love passion, and I think our listeners do too, and we appreciate all that you do.
Thanks so much. This was fun.
That's great. That's going to do it for today's edition of Optimal Health. I'm Pete Wagner. Have a great day. So long, everybody.